Everything about disasters costs money. Preventing them, responding to them, recovering from them, it is all incredibly expensive. Everything we have touched on in this podcast so far is part of the complex and costly world that disasters have created. So who pays for all of this? Who should pay for it? The answers to those two questions may vary widely based on where you live and what you've lived through. The answers have also changed over the course of our history. 100 years ago, your great-grandparents would have answered those questions very differently from how you and I would. When it comes to paying for disasters, we are in an interesting moment in the United States. Some of that has to do with politics. President Donald Trump's administration has put forth some radical plans to reshape the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, which is primarily responsible for disaster prevention and recovery. President Trump has said he wants states to take on more responsibility when it comes to disasters, and his administration has cut off billions of dollars in funding that we have used for many decades to prevent and recover from disasters across the country. In response to this, we've seen many states and emergency management professionals both begin to recognize the need for FEMA to reform and also to highlight the critical role that FEMA can play in a disaster. FEMA itself is pretty broadly misunderstood. It actually cannot help communities with everything. Disasters, meanwhile, are more common and more devastating. Despite the politics, there is a role that local governments can play in preventing and responding to disasters. The question of who should pay for all of this, though, has never been more controversial nor more relevant. To sort through all of this, I've invited my colleague Kristen Smith back on the show, and we will be joined by another of our Headwaters Economics flood experts, Bridget Mitchell. Talking about the limits of federal funding when it comes to disaster prevention is one thing, but Bridget and Chris have seen it firsthand, and they have some fixes, and I want to hear them. So let's get into it. Chris, great to have you back on the show. Bridget, welcome, and thanks for joining us. When communities or people experience a disaster, there's a lot of talk about making them whole again. Chris, one of the things that you and I have talked about is this idea that the federal government is tasked with making communities whole. Can you break down a little bit of the history of that? Why do we expect the federal government to participate here?
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me back on the podcast. When you look at the history of disasters over the last 100 years, you can see why the federal government is a really critical stakeholder. Dating back into the 20s, we had a massive flood on the Mississippi River, and the 60s, big hurricanes. These disasters just completely overwhelmed both local and state governments, and they needed support. FEMA wasn't established until 1979 by President Carter, which is probably a lot later than most of us assume. The idea was because some of these disasters are so big, so devastating, without a federal agency coordinating all of the players, disaster recovery was pretty piecemeal and scattered. There was a real need to bring a coordinating force to that. FEMA has three main programs that I think are really important to talk about when you're thinking about what does it mean to recover? What does it mean to be made whole? So the three programs are public assistance, which this is basically funding to help local governments, state governments do debris removal, maybe fix roads and streets that got damaged, address public facilities. Electric utilities can use this funding. It's the biggest part of recovery funding. The second program is individual assistance, designed to provide basic needs to people who are impacted by the disaster. So think, you know, your emergency food, bottled water, it can pay for temporary housing. This is a relatively small amount of funding. It is not designed to replace insurance or to provide for all the needs that a person has after a disaster. The third funding pool is the hazard mitigation assistance. And this is funding that's available after disaster to hopefully think through how do you want your community to change in the future to be more resilient to disasters. And just an interesting kind of point here, when we're looking at what's happening to FEMA under this current administration, While we've seen public assistance and individual assistance being approved, we haven't seen the hazard mitigation funding being approved, which is a big shift in how FEMA has operated compared to the past.
So that means that the new FEMA, in whatever form it will take, will be investing less money in preventing or preparing for disasters.
I think that's the big question mark that everyone's asking. Is FEMA going to shift to really just having its role predominantly be disaster recovery? What we've seen over the last 10, 15 years is FEMA was shifting the other way to be more proactive, to invest more in the mitigation side. So helping communities reduce risk before the disaster occurs. Under this administration, we're all waiting to see how this is going to shift again or not.
So one of the things we're going to be talking about a lot in this podcast, and we've mentioned already, is these ideas of funding prevention for disasters and funding mitigation and also funding recovery. I think we need to break down for people what we mean by these terms and where the federal government comes into play when we talk about prevention, mitigation, and recovery. So Bridget, tell me a bit about those. How are they different?
First, thank you, Ryan, for having me on the show. Recovery is immediately following a disaster. Mitigation is something that would occur in advance of a disaster. It's something to be proactive and preventative of impacts happening from the next disaster. The way FEMA is structured, there's two different groups that handle recovery and mitigation. And granted, there's overlap, but the way they operate, their breakdown in the resources they provide and how they're provided is very different.
Going back to this wholeness concept, we cannot expect the federal government to necessarily make things better. They can recreate what we had before, which may not have worked, but to like push us into a better, safer place, that is not necessarily the role of the federal government, nor its ability. The Trump administration has just proposed a radical re-envisioning of the role of FEMA, and that has been preceded by several months of what we call federal disaster grants that have been canceled. And we're talking about money that helps fund wildfire preparation plans or projects that would protect homes from flooding. And there's lots of talk about states needing to step up into this void and being on the hook for more money to help communities pay for this. And I know, Chris, you've made the argument that having states fill a broader role isn't necessarily out of step with FEMA's intent, though.
Right. So when you look at FEMA's guiding framework, the idea is that recovery should be locally developed, state managed, and federally supported. FEMA can't come in and do the disaster recovery work unless a state actually requests a disaster declaration. So FEMA comes in on behalf of the state to work with local communities. Again, it doesn't mean that the systems are perfect, and you can talk to any community that's gone through a disaster and you'll hear positive and negative things about how FEMA works or hasn't worked for their community. But I think the important thing to recognize here is that when a disaster is declared, it's because the scale and the magnitude of the impacts are so intense and high that you really do need all hands on deck. We can look at recent disasters and see clear examples of this. When you're thinking about Hurricane Helene, we're seeing the estimates for that one disaster at over $60 billion. That's more than double the state's entire operating budget. So when you think about what would it even take for the state to be able to address a disaster of that magnitude, it would be a huge financial obstacle for them. And taxpayers would have to spend a lot of money. When you have a federal system like the Disaster Relief Fund available to all states, it provides the resources that are really needed and beyond the scope of any one community, certainly, and even any one state.
But I think in order to understand exactly what role a local government has, I think we need to back up a bit and talk about how financial systems in governments work. This is all about money, right? And who has the money to do what? So where does money come from if you're a local government? So I know this is going to be a bit wonky, but disasters really have the ability to bankrupt communities if they aren't careful. So I want to break down a little bit. Where does money come from for local governments? Where does the city that you live in get its money?
Our local and state budgets rely on a mix of tax revenues. It's usually some mix of state property and income taxes. budgets work best when that revenue and your expenses are predictable and foreseeable. You can plan ahead. And of course, that's the complete opposite of a disaster. Typically, a disaster occurs, you had no idea it was coming, and now all of a sudden you have this massive amount of expenses that you have to figure out how to make your budget work with. So that's an enormous challenge and a real shock to the system.
So I think, Bridget, a lot of what we talked about here is what communities need to do that they can't expect the federal government to do. And what I'm hearing is that there are a lot of basic things we need to make cities run that just need to be in a good condition and not vulnerable. And yet I'm hearing that all of these things are way more expensive than cities have the budgets for. So why do communities have these financial needs that they can not meet?
So communities need infrastructure. They need roads. They need sewer systems. Rural communities who have 50 to 300 people need the same infrastructure that cities need. Granted, the cities have more, larger, but that cost burden is really significant on our rural, low-capacity communities. You might have the same miles of road in a community that has 500 people versus a city, but their tax base for that small community is so much less than a city. So for them to come up with millions of dollars to provide fresh drinking water, to handle their sewer system, to have the roads they drive on is significantly more challenging than it is for some of these larger communities.
So then in that case, a local government would have to do what normal people do, is they have to cover expenses that their budget can't account for. So then they're going to have to take out loans to pay for stuff. And I know that loans in local governments don't just cover disaster expenses. They can also cover really expensive infrastructure projects like a stormwater system or upgrades to water treatment plants. When communities take out loans to afford these items, they will go get a bond. And if communities have what we might think of as a good credit history, their loans will be more favorable, they'll be easier to pay off, they won't be as expensive. If they have a history of not being able to pay back large loans like this, then they will have a low credit score. And what this means is that a local community will not be able to dish out money to pay for critical infrastructure or community projects. So, Chris, can you just talk a bit about how does the need to take out loans or bonds intersect with disasters and the big bills that they create?
When you're thinking about how local governments are functioning and planning ahead for your infrastructure projects, your capital improvement projects, it's very common to take out a loan or a bond. 90% of our local infrastructure is paid for by debt financing. When you're also thinking in the context of disaster, a lot of our mitigation projects, so projects to decrease the risk from whatever disaster you're trying to address, can also be bonded and taken loans out. We see two kind of things that can happen with disasters in the bond market. One is that if you experience a disaster, it's fairly common for your credit rating to take a hit. So what that means in practice is folks are saying, okay, maybe you've lost population, you don't have as much revenue coming in to pay for the bond, and the credit rating agencies are flagging that as a risk. So now all of a sudden, as you've experienced enormous impacts, you likely have big infrastructure improvements. So when you try to borrow money, that's even more expensive than it was before the disaster, which is a barrier to recovering. The second thing that we can see is we know that the bond market is increasingly taking into account climate risk. So even if you haven't had a disaster, if you are being flagged as a place that has high risk, you might start to actually see your interest rates go up again.
So let's bring this down to earth a little bit more. Talk to me about an actual community that we might know or that you've worked in where you've seen disasters and difficulty with public finance mix in a bad way.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you two examples, both very different. The first is a small community in Montana that we've worked with where they had a series of really intense storms, high wind events that have done a ton of damage. but because they're relatively small, they're not qualifying for things like FEMA aid or federal disaster assistance. They also aren't qualifying for state assistance, but they're having repetitive disasters at a smaller scale that are causing really high costs for debris removal. And this community is so small that even just that additional cost on their budget that they weren't prepared to spend is creating a lot of problems. So when I talked to the county commissioner about this, he said it was death by a thousand cuts on their budget. The other example that came to mind is actually from a town called Cairo, Illinois. This is a community that used to be very thriving. It's where the Ohio and the Mississippi River come together. It was an inland port. You might remember it from Huckleberry Finn. And what's happened in that community is that they've undergone a very significant economic transition. And what we know about disasters is whatever's going on in your community economically, socially, disasters tend to exacerbate the problem. So because, not surprisingly, at the confluence of the Mississippi and Ohio, there's flood risk. As this community has undergone massive economic transition, they've also experienced a series of repetitive flooding. And what's happened there is they've lost 90% of their population over the last 70, 80 years. I think I provide that example not to say, look at the magnitude of this problem, but to ask the question, what would it take to actually address the root problem here and reverse that trend? It takes very long-term and sustained investment in a place to both address the root of the problem, economic transition in this example, but also the disaster risk. You can't really do one without the other. So particularly when you're thinking about short and long-term disaster recovery, there is an assumption that the federal government pays the majority of those costs. But actually, my coworker, Kimiko Barrett, here at Headwaters Economics, has done an analysis of this. And she found that over the long term, 46% of total costs from a disaster fall onto local stakeholders. And that was for wildfire disasters.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Handy from Headwaters Economics. I want to thank you for listening to our podcast, and I encourage you to share it with your friends, coworkers, and community members. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have any of your own burning questions about wildfire issues in your community, please email them to me at ryan@headwaterseconomics.org. So whether you like it or not, these expenses that we're talking about, these high-dollar projects that will prevent disasters from happening or lessen their impacts or recover from them, that money will fall on you. It will fall on your local government, on your state government, even under the best of circumstances where the federal government is playing a large role. So if communities need to borrow money to do all of this work, why wouldn't they just go to the federal government for that money? Why would they bother to take out a loan or a bond?
I think there's a couple of things that are going on. When a community is trying to access federal grants, there's a lot of challenges. One, it's costly to put an application together. In some instances, it could cost $20,000, $30,000. So that's a heavy lift right off the bat. Second, a lot of these grant opportunities are competitive. So there's no guarantees. You might invest this money and walk away with nothing. And the third piece is there's an administrative and a regulatory, I don't want to call it a burden, but a lift associated with these resources. The last point on this is the way our grant systems work is they're pretty siloed. If you have a flood project, you would go to FEMA to access funding for the flood project. If you have a recreation project, you go somewhere else. If you have a housing project, you go somewhere else. But there are projects that encompass all of those things. So it's really challenging for the local government to find funding to fit all the different components of a project. And sometimes loans give more flexibility and allow communities to do these projects that have multiple benefits.
So if a community gets a loan or a bond, it's like they're getting the money directly without the administrative burden or limits on where they can spend it.
Correct.
So, Chris, anything you would add to that? Why would a government seek a loan versus a grant? I mean, I do still see a risk with a loan. They have to pay it off. And as you just talked about, their ability to pay off their loans isn't always certain, and it can fluctuate based on their population or tax base.
Yeah, I agree with everything Bridget just said. It's a really tricky decision at the local government level to figure out, should we bond this? Should we go after a state or a federal grant? Should we go after private money? A lot of times, particularly over the last 4 years under the Biden administration, we saw an influx of federal funding, particularly in competitive grants, that we saw a lot of movement. A lot of local governments started thinking, maybe we should go after a federal grant. There's money to be had. By going after a federal grant, we can lessen the amount of burden to local taxpayers. And that's really important, particularly in an era of rising cost of living, rising housing prices. I think what we're seeing now with the Trump administration kind of retracting a lot of that federal grant money, in some ways, it's a return to how we used to think, which is more of a scarcity mindset of how can we dig up some money and is a loan or a bond the right tool here? It gives a lot more flexibility, like Bridget said. It can also really decrease the timeline. A federal grant takes a long time to get that application together. It takes a long time for federal agencies to review them and make their selections. So there are real trade-offs here. And I think it's going to be interesting. I know at Headwaters Economics, as we're thinking about our community assistance, we've spent the last few years helping communities try to access some of these federal programs and this federal funding that came online. And we're pivoting now. We're trying to think, if that funding's not there, are there state sources, or how can we be creative and help communities find more funding at the local level? My hunch is we'll see a lot of our technical assistance providers, our community assistance providers, the philanthropists and nonprofits in the room, really trying to work with local communities to help sort this out.
So I think the moment that we're in now is one particular tool in that toolbox, namely the federal government, is shifting, and its role is going to change. Our argument is that it probably should change in certain instances to align with the intent of the federal government's role in disaster prevention and recovery from the very beginning. So part of what I wanted to do here was talk about our expectations for the federal government. Years ago, when I was a newspaper reporter, I was covering the devastating floods of 2013 in Colorado. One woman I interviewed, her home managed to survive on the edge of this river, and it was like clinging to this cliff. And she was desperate for federal government support. She had several agencies kind of earmarked for things that she would need. The bridge to get to her home had been torn out. Her home had to be stabilized. She didn't want it to be destroyed. So she took this bed sheet and she hung it up on her porch, and she listed all the federal agencies she needed support from and drew a box next to each. And as each federal agency stepped up and gave her what she needed, she put a check in the box. But it was so interesting because she kind of wanted to live this sort of off-grid life, you know, away from a government. She didn't live in an incorporated community, but she expected the federal government to be there. So I think that is a perfect illustration of what we misunderstand about the federal government.
Yeah, I think that's a common misconception. And we can't expect FEMA to know what is best for every community in our country. That's just a huge lift. Where our state partners come in is they bridge this gap between FEMA and our local communities. They have this great responsibility to support their towns and cities within their state and help translate the regulations or the resources that are available from FEMA and make them more accessible.
So this helps me reframe some of the comments that President Donald Trump has offered that I know have caused concern with people like us who work with communities that experience disasters. He has really emphasized that states need to play a greater role. And in a sense, we agree with him.
I think there's a great opportunity for states to play a bigger role, but they need resources to do that. They can't do it under the current funding system. So, I mean, one of the big challenges is staff and funding for mitigation projects that will make communities better prepared for future disasters.
I think one of the things that we hear, both when we talk with our local and our state partners, is there's a real need to think about disaster recovery reform in a serious way. And this goes beyond FEMA. There are 30 different agencies that do disaster recovery. That's everything from HUD to the Small Business Administration and, of course, FEMA. It's incredibly complicated. There's no one application. I completely agree with many people in the Trump administration saying that this needs to be simplified and better coordinated. In my opinion, that's going to take a substantial amount of resources and capacity to really rethink and streamline the processes. And there's also, I think, a huge need for federal partners to work and reimagine the systems with how they interact with our state and local partners to make sure that they have the resources and the capacity to meet the needs on the ground. That's not the case right now. Many of our communities, when you go and talk to the emergency manager, they're wearing a lot of different hats. They might be a quarter time. They don't even have one full-time emergency manager at the county level working on disasters. So if a disaster occurs in that setting, of course, that community is going to be quickly overwhelmed. So the system right now is fragile, and we're seeing disasters become more frequent, more extreme, causing more damages. So the need is growing.
So we could do a whole nother podcast about how to reform the federal government's approach to disasters. What I'm hearing, though, is that a lot of communities right now are at risk of going into this downward spiral you highlighted earlier when you were talking about Cairo and a community in Montana. For a lot of the reasons you said, we have weaknesses in local governments, people are overworked, their funding is tricky. So we've established that the federal government cannot be the end-all be-all when it comes to disaster prevention or recovery. And we know there are some things that communities can do that only they can do. An example of this is building codes and land use codes that limit how people build and where they build. Bridget, I've heard both you and Chris say that even knowing all of this, some communities are just too small to tackle these kinds of projects or take these financial risks that states are really better positioned to step in here.
I think states are that middle ground where they have a handle on the unique characteristics of the local communities and they have more resources than those communities. There's some efficiency with working at that scale. And there's some great examples of states or regional programs who are providing resources and guidance that multiple communities can use. I think of Mile High Flood District in Colorado. That is a great example of a program that provides guidance documents that a lot of communities across the state of Colorado adopt and implement. And they will base their local codes, their local process off of that information provided by Mile High Flood District. That's why I think they're the best solution. Those nuances of the local fabric of a community are going to be lost at the federal scale.
My favorite example to talk about is the state of Vermont. Vermont's had a series of really devastating floods over the last decade. And one of the things that they were seeing is they had a lot of mobile homes that were located in really high-risk areas. At the same time, when they were talking with their FEMA partners, it's really hard to get a mobile home buyout project to qualify for federal funding. So instead, Vermont used seed money from a federal support system to create a fund to help buy out properties that they knew were just going to have difficulty qualifying for FEMA funding. And since that initial seed money, now the state is actually seeing the benefits of it on the ground and using general operating funding to keep that state pool of money intact. So that's a really promising and innovative solution that one state is doing to get people out of the way of the flood.
I like this example because I think it brings us full circle in our conversation back to the federal government and the role it can play in disaster prevention and recovery. So I want to get both of your thoughts on where we go from here. At the start of this conversation, we talked about how there's a ton of uncertainty for communities who rely on the federal government to help them clean up after a disaster and prevent it. We don't know what form FEMA is going to take. These radical changes have been proposed, and yet the form the federal government takes in this whole process is essential. And yet it cannot make a difference if your local community isn't there with its own funding solutions and vision and ideas and a sense of what your community needs to continue to thrive. So I guess I want to hear, is there one thing a local or state government should do tomorrow to give themselves a better chance at weathering this particular storm? And starting with you, Bridget, what do you think that should be?
Can I give you two?
Yeah. Give me two.
So two. One is focus on mitigation and not necessarily just the recovery. Prepare for these disasters. Understand your risk and look at solutions to be better prepared when that next flood or wildfire is going to occur. I think we've heard these numbers where every dollar invested in mitigation efforts is $6 saved on the recovery side. It's a significant savings if communities will focus on mitigation and be proactive about how to better prepare for those future disasters. That's my first. And the second point, and I think we've hammered this throughout this podcast, is that this is not a federal agency problem. This is not just a state agency problem. It's not local. It really takes all three of them. And I think it's important for local governments to drive this resilience. I think a really cool example of local communities being proactive is this community we're working with who is developing a stormwater utility. With this utility, they are going to have dedicated funding to tackle some of their capital improvement projects so that they can continue to grow and have adequate stormwater infrastructure in place to do that. That's a really innovative approach for a local community to take that initiative.
I completely agree, Bridget. I have two closing thoughts. One is the need to rethink how we do local and state budgeting for disasters. And that's everything from states creating their own funding pools for mitigation projects and providing more flexibility. One of the big issues with local budgets is they're often highly constrained by how they can raise revenue, and that's because of state policies. And so maybe changing some of that. The second thing that I really see, and again, this is riffing off of what Bridget said, is just the importance of relationship building. We've seen firsthand why that social capital is so important when you're preparing for disasters, but also on the recovery side. And I'll just give an example from last year that I found really powerful. We were invited to participate in a big tour of eastern Montana. So it's some of the most rural and remote parts of our country. And our state partners at Department of Emergency Services organized this tour that brought in FEMA Region 8 people, FEMA headquarters staff members, state agency folks, and then nonprofit partners. And we all went and talked to people on the ground in different communities across eastern Montana to understand the challenges and for the community members also to put a face to what is FEMA. FEMA is not an abstract thing. FEMA is a collection of people who are trying to help you.
So Bridget, Chris, we've had a really complicated conversation about how we pay for disasters, what role the federal government plays, what role the states should play. And I think what you've left me thinking is that we should not give up. I know things are uncertain now. Radical changes have been proposed, some of which are good ideas and some of which have put a lot of communities in a really difficult financial position that could have far-reaching and potentially disastrous consequences. And I hate to harp on this idea that we all just need to communicate better and make friends, because as Chris said, that's hard. It's hard to build relationships, particularly in an environment where there might be some mistrust or uncertainty of what it means to prevent a disaster or recover from one. And yet I'm walking away from this conversation feeling that we are always intended to work on these things together. There was never one silver bullet solution. And we have always known this. And to continue to understand this is the solution. So that's where we're going to end it today. I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to chat. Thanks always to our listeners for being here. I encourage you to share this podcast with your friends, family, and coworkers, and please rate it on whatever platform you use. Join us for the next episode when I will be back discussing what happened to the Grand Canyon Lodge, which was burned to the ground in mid-July by a massive wildfire, and what we can do to keep something like that from happening again.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Burning Questions, a podcast about wildfire. To see more about our work, visit us at headwaterseconomics.org. This episode was produced by Ryan Handy, Doug Green, and edited by Brent Powell. This podcast is a production of Headwaters Economics. If you found this episode valuable, please share it with others. This organization is an equal opportunity provider.